Observer.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels in the studio for what, like the third week in a row?
Yeah, I just called it at the playground ahead of time. All-time radio guest.
All-time radio guest. Okay, well, we're happy to have you, even though you totally
can't get rid of me. So
everyone else.
You better be.
Yeah, I guess so. Also with us via phone is our Houston correspondent, staff writer Emily DePrang. Welcome, Emily.
Hello.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by immigration attorney Carlos Spector to talk about a political asylum case he's taken on involving refugees from Honduras. But first, we have some news to discuss. As of recording this episode, we're three or so weeks out from the runoff election. This week, Senator Dan Patrick and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst had it out in a public debate on Dallas's WFAA Channel 8. And interestingly enough, the debate started with a question I had on the last episode of Observer Radio. Why was Dan Patrick wearing a tie, a coat, but no shirt in one of Dewhurst's campaign's attack ads? What do you guys make of this debate?
It was pretty hard to watch.
Yes, very hard to watch.
I'd start from there.
Yeah.
I have some talking points about the debate for our conversation, but I thought instead we might just yell over one another.
Yeah, maybe I'll just interrupt you.
Answer the question, Patrick.
No, Emily, just be honest with me.
Tell the truth, Jonathan.
Listen, you lie.
Yeah, it was very difficult to watch.
No, you're difficult to watch. I'm sorry. It was just this. Well, so, I mean, this is not David Dewhurst's best venue, I think, and I'm not sure what is,
right.
for sort of, you know, airing out his proposals and showing off his personality. But it definitely was sort of the place Dan Patrick was most comfortable. I mean, there were things watching it where you'd see Dan Patrick would turn to the camera and sort of address the voters.
He did that a lot, yeah.
And, you know, Dewhurst sort of caught on to what was happening, and every now and then would make these sort of, like, fleeting glances at his own camera, but mostly just sort of looked at Patrick the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all, like, very awkward, and, I mean, as a reporter, and, you know, you got a feel for the moderators of the thing, just kind of what
no.
it must be like trying to, I mean, you didn't have any sympathy
for them. You disagree?
No, I didn't, because the format, for me, it was about the debate was about two things. And one was, I don't want to cut you off, Patrick, but I'm going to talk over you now.
This is in keeping with the theme, so it's the form.
Yeah. No, I'm just playing. I didn't really feel for the moderators because it was out of control most of the time. And I feel like the format was a terrible idea. And it was a debate about how debate formats are important. I feel like the moderators could have, they were more aggressive than some I've seen, but it was a train wreck, and I think it didn't have to be.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with that. And there were, you know, moments they just, you could see him just kind of sitting back and letting it all happen in front of them. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, it really seems like something a film student could, you know, do some work on, sort of critically analyzing just sort of every turn in this. You know, it also was probably the ugliest this race has gotten yet. Kind of, you know, with a few more weeks to go, you wonder how much uglier it can be than this. I mean, the debate began with Dan Patrick's defense of removing his shirt in this photo, which is a pretty legit one. He says, well, I literally sold the shirt off my back.
To raise money.
To raise money for kids.
Yeah.
And Dewhurst, you know, I think he apologized. At least he said that he took the ad down. He tried to take it down.
It's very difficult to tell.
It wasn't soon enough for Dan Patrick. And then once the debate's over, what does he do? Is he comes out and releases a new web ad, which includes a photo or some video footage of Dan Patrick with his shirt off again, getting painted oil or blue, you know, from back in his sportscaster days.
By a couple of ladies.
By a couple of ladies. That's true. I mean, so...
I thought made him look... amazing.
You're saying really that the Smurf look was an improvement?
It wasn't the blue so much as, like, we have to remember that, you know, Bush got elected twice. Like, the guy that you want to have a beer with, unfortunately, gets elected. And that made Dan, I don't think Dewhurst has ever been painted blue by women. And it made me think the voters were kind of like, oh, I don't know. Patrick's the kind of guy that I could really get painted blue with some chicks with. I'm actually kind of serious. I think that just as you say, going again with the shirtless and just the throwback, just everything that he had, mm-hmm. everything that Dewhurst had on Patrick was so old. It's like, do you really not have anything on this guy that's not from the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, he was showing off his research team skills and I guess his video production skills. That was 30 seconds worth of a strong parody of of Let It Go from Frozen.
I had to watch Emma Stone beating Jimmy Fallon at a rap battle again right after that just to get that song out of my head.
I'm glad that you have a method for doing that. I think we can agree that this was a bit more of a pissing match than it was a discussion of the issues, which is certainly something that we've been talking about for a few weeks. We mentioned it last week in regard to the governor's race. What issues did you see covered at all, if any, in this debate? What did people take away from them?
I think the attempts at covering issues were kind of tragic because mm-hmm. it's bad enough that you kind of expect Dan Patrick as a radio person to be pretty good at this talking over and rebutting and challenging. But when it came down to the issues, I actually wrote down two quotes that I thought summed up the two of them talking about issues. When they finally get down to talking about property tax, what Dewhurst said was, what I want to do is make our county appraisal districts elected instead of appointed. And then Dan Patrick turns around and says, as Lieutenant Governor, I will get it done. Job one, secure the border. School choice, reduce your property taxes. I'm going to get it done. Not enough people are going to know and care the difference that it's going to make on their bottom line to have their county appraisal districts elected rather than appointed. And the thing is, I think Dewhurst is probably really good at his job, but I saw him get trounced tragically in a debate with Ted Cruz. This is not his area.
This is kind of what's left for him in the last few weeks here before the runoff. And, he's going into it at a big disadvantage already just based on, the big turnout Patrick got in the first time around. These guys both agree on so much. There was another line that Dewhurst had late in the debate when he's quoting an old line from Dan Patrick when Patrick says that he and Dewhurst agree with each other 98% of the time, mm-hmm. and then Dewhurst comes in and he says, "Well, quite frankly, that's more than my wife agrees with me."
I know, and there's just silence. It was just so sad.
Another line that sort of fell dead on arrival.
But tough crowd.
It was a tough crowd there.
What was it he said? Do you also smell snake oil for hair?
Snake oil for the hair loss, Dan?
And then there was when he Patrick's hammering him and he says, why didn't you take the ad down? I think that was one of the times that Patrick was hammering him. And he said, "Are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay, Patrick?" And everybody's like, "Yeah, Patrick's fine. Patrick's owning."
Seems like he's doing all right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Feel bad for the guy.
I mean, I guess the most substantive thing you'd look at here and Patrick hit Dewhurst on leaving the floor of the Senate during the abortion mm-hmm. debate last summer, and sort of a key night. Why wasn't he there? There were some sort of managerial flubs on the Republican side that enabled a lot of what happened that last summer, just in scheduling things out and timing them. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at this as who is your Republican leader that's going to be most effective in that job, I suppose that there were some more substantive points there. But as far as how you're going to, what policy changes you want to see, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference in what these folks
are after. Well, there was one point, which was that on equal pay,
yep.
Patrick said he wouldn't even let the bill come to the floor, even if the votes were there for it.
Right.
And Dewhurst said, "I believe in equal pay." He said basically he would support not only that he would bring the bill, but that he supports the idea of the bill. And I thought that Patrick had just a really sly way of talking about it. He was like, "Well, I think that women and women business owners should be able to pay women more for better work. Like the problem is that the state's going to make you all get paid exactly the same, and that's going to deprive women who work harder of getting paid more." as opposed to addressing systemic injustice. And he said, well, I just don't believe in regulation. I thought that was
Don't blame
was
me,
remarkable.
I just work here.
Well, guys, thanks for confirming my thoughts that it was very difficult to watch. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Patrick Michael's story in the May issue of the Observer chronicles the trials of one mother who says her children were stolen by her own parents with help from the state of Texas. The story follows the 7-year legal fight that followed, though no evidence was ever presented that the children had been harmed in her care. Patrick, tell me about Sarah Bryan.
Okay, so this is a pretty personal story, but it's one of these that sort of illuminates the ways the court system can work, especially for folks that don't really have a lot of agency with it and don't have money to hire big lawyers and sort of feel on the losing end of it a lot of times. Sarah Bryan grew up in Nacogdoches in East Texas, her lived with her parents for a long time, and she'd been in and out of the house. But when she was 23 years old, she was a single mother at that point, and living with her parents. And she decided that she'd had enough living there. She wanted to move out on her own. And when she left with her daughter, who was about a year old at that point, maybe a little bit less, she left the house. And her parents were so concerned that she had left their care at the age of 23 that they went out and they got a mental health warrant signed out against her and had her picked up by the cops, driven to the hospital for an evaluation, and they got an emergency order saying that they would be the caretakers for her daughter instead. The story covers the legal battles that followed that, which went on for 7 years of these temporary orders.
In which her parents tried to get full custody.
Right, and that's what the suit is about, is over permanent conservatorship of her daughter and then her son as well. Each of the all the time with temporary orders in place as the girl grows up from age 1 to age 8, and the son is 5 or 6 years old now too. Her father swore out in this affidavit against her that she had a history of bipolar disorder. She had suicide attempts in her past, all of which were before her daughter was born. And there was never any allegation that she had endangered her children, except that there was this potential for harm because she had been diagnosed as bipolar and she wasn't taking her medications now that she was on her own.
Oh, wait a minute. So there were never any allegations that she had actually been abusive or had put her children in harm, but there was a concern about her mental health?
So the grandparents have standing under Texas law to file a suit like this if there's the potential for physical or mental harm. And I'm forgetting the exact phrasing in the law, but it's the potential for some kind of problem raising the children based mm-hmm. on physical or mental well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So although you had these ongoing court battles, what you basically had was someone losing their children over a diagnosis, not over any actual harm or even reason to expect harm to the children.
And it really put her in a rough position because she left her parents' house to get away from what she describes as, they're controlling her and they're trying to force her to take these medications that she doesn't feel like she needs. And she's trying to get away from her history of, being with the same psychologist that was diagnosing her this whole time when she was a child. It started when her diagnosis was at 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes it as sort of an accident. Her friend's dad said she had it, and she went to the doctor and says, yeah, somebody told me I'm bipolar. And he said, okay, here's your diagnosis then. That sounds good. Here's some treatment.
Yeah.
So she says it was all done in a really cursory way that sort of followed her. But she gets before the judge, and there's this, the legal standard is all written out in very specific language. But when you break it down to a case like this, it's just like, who do you believe? It's all really vague, and it's this messy stuff.
At the point that the judge, the thing that killed me about your story was that, at the point that this judge is finally considering this case and says, well, we'll go and have her evaluated, and we'll kind of have to go with whatever the. They tried to bring an objective evaluation to it,
right.
And not just rely on this old diagnosis. But whenever this psychiatrist decided that she was not a threat, the judge did what?
Yeah, I mean, he says in the transcript from court, he says, well, we're going to hire this evaluator. You're going to go in there, and if he says you're fine, you're a safe parent, then I won't have any other choice but to give your kids back. And she says, okay, and she goes in for the evaluation, and it's you know, the evaluation comes back that she's mentally stable, doesn't show any signs of bipolar disorder, for one thing, or any other sort of dangerous behavior around her kids. And basically, her parents have a lawyer who's effective enough to convince the judge that, well, you're not just going to believe this one guy. Here's her old doctor, mm-hmm. who diagnosed her as bipolar from the start. And all of a sudden, the judge is agreeing to sort of weigh these two professional opinions. And it just becomes this long, drawn-out thing. The goalposts kind of just keep moving farther and farther.
So let's talk about that. Where is she now in all of this?
Well, I mean, we'll spoil the end of the story a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, she got pregnant a third time, and sort of out of fear that her parents were going to sort of repeat this playbook and take her youngest daughter away, she went into hiding. So she left town and started to take a more activist approach. You know, she saw the way that the courts had been working against her in her hometown, and how little power she had there. And she started talking to other mothers who had gone through some kind of similar thing and felt the same way. And she has this idea that she wants to be an advocate for people in similar situations to hers. Obviously, these stories are all going to be so different from family to family.
Sure.
But at the same time, she was in hiding and not keeping up with her mail at the P.O. box that she'd given the court. So she missed the last couple hearing notices, which, after years of silence in courts, in the courts, came back up earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
Without her there in court, the judge signed some final orders in her case that gave her parents, full conservatorship, full care of the kids. So it's not temporary anymore.
Right.
It's to the point where she'd have to appeal that case now, win an appeals court, and then it would go back to that same judge in that same family court.
Wow.
Back to start.
Yeah. At the same time, she's also now racking up $350 a month in child support that she has to pay based on those final orders, too.
For the two kids.
Yeah. So $350 total.
Wow.
And so, you know, is there much precedent for people losing their children over a diagnosis like this?
Well, I mean, you talk about the story, and the details kind of make you think, well, how is this even possible? I mean,
yeah.
It sounds
right.
Terrible. One of the most surprising things to me was how unsurprised some of the lawyers were who I spoke with. And I spoke to,
really?
You know, some of the folks at the, you know, who had the family law section of the state bar. And sort of sketched out the details of the case, and they said, well, especially with mental health issues, these things happen all the time, where it's this fuzzy standard of the mental well-being of the child, and potential for harm. I mean, you're asking judges to guess what's going to happen in the future,
right?
And if they guess wrong, if they guess that there is no potential for harm, and then the kids are harmed, I mean, no judge wants to be in that position.
Sure.
So, you know, what seems to them at the time like, you know, playing it safe ends up in situations like this, where the kids are taken away from a parent who, you know, seems, based on her behavior as a mother so far, like a perfectly capable and fit mother.
Well, the story is Childhood Lost. You can read it at texasobserver.org. Patrick and Emily, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Joining us via phone from El Paso, right? El Paso?
I'm on my way. I'm outside of San Antonio on my way to Harlingen.
Okay. Joining us from outside of San Antonio on the road is attorney Carlos Spector, who has taken on a number of political asylum cases and founded a nonprofit called Mexicans in Exile. Mr. Spector, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. My pleasure to be with you guys.
On May 3rd, 61 people crossed the border near McAllen seeking political asylum 48 of them were fleeing Honduras and the crime and income inequality that has become the norm there since the 2009 coup of the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya. Mr. Spector, you volunteered to help these Hondurans gain asylum. First question, how did you hear about this situation and get involved?
This represents an effort by Central American immigrants to obtain free passage through Mexico City on their way to the U.S. And over the years, the Mexican federal police, as well as Mexican Immigration Service and the cartels, have extorted, murdered, raped, kidnapped, disappeared Central Americans on their way to the U.S. So the situation is so dire for many Central Americans that what they did in conjunction with Mexican human rights organizations is help them get from Central America through Mexico, denouncing the persecution by the cartels and the Mexican government. And 1,000 of them were marching in a caravan through Mexico City, through Mexico. But when they got to San Luis Potosí, 250 of them decided to continue going north, which is the U.S. And so it wasn't planned to come here, but it was a caravan.
Right.
Now, when they got to San Luis Potosí, they called me asking for a legal overview of what difficulties they were going to face, and 250 of them wanted to come initially, and I was able to talk to the organizers and tell them how difficult it was and the possibilities of being freed, and basically gave them some insight into who should apply for asylum, and we were able to pare it down to like 60 and looking at the most vulnerable members of that caravan. But what makes this historic is that it was a caravan denouncing, it was a transnational immigrant caravan, involving all of North America, that is to say in Central America,
mm-hmm.
denouncing the persecution at home, denouncing the persecution in Mexico, and seeking asylum in the U.S. So it's a very historic, interesting movement that I felt compelled to enter the fray and to help and try to get legal representation for them, because they're a very, very strong case that really does show the persecution, not the end. These aren't economic refugees.
Right.
These are political refugees that qualify for asylum. And I think that's why most of them have been released already. We've got several in San Antonio that we're trying to get out. But of the 60, I would estimate that 2/3 have been released. And that's unusual as hell as well.
Let me ask you real quickly. I mean, it's my understanding that poverty and violence are not recognized as credible claims for asylum under U.S. law. So what then is different about this case?
Well, what's different about this case is that it's outright political opinion. Remember, the essence of an asylum claim under U.S. and international law is that you have to be persecuted on account of 5 grounds: race, national minority, religion, political opinion, or social group, membership of a particular social group. And the classic asylum claim is political opinion. And so the reason that they're seeking asylum is because they left their countries, they denounce it in an international forum, they denounce the persecution at home, they denounce the persecution in Mexico, and they're seeking asylum. So it's not very difficult to show their political opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That the reason they're afraid to go back is on the basis of their public denunciation of the cartels in the entire continent. So they can't go back home. And that makes it very difficult. Now, generally, violence has not been the basis for asylum, which is not necessarily the case here. But I've won a couple of cases on the basis of violence. And I am pushing an alternative paradigm on Mexican asylum cases and on Central American cases, arguing that violence is a basis. Why? Because one has to understand the violence from the perspective of the sending country. And I just picked up a case yesterday in Ojinaga. They sliced the throat of an 86-year-old mother. And so the question becomes, what is the slicing and the quartering and the macheting to death an 86-year-old woman have to do with what does that represent in terms of violence? And so violence under certain circumstances, it alters, seeks to alter behavior, which is a political decision on behalf of the cartels or the government. And so the more violent, you know, chopping off your legs because you didn't pay extortion. I've got a client like that.
Right.
You know, raping somebody in front of their family by the cops. You know, that type of stuff is not meant just to silence that individual. It's not personal revenge or retribution. It's a political message to the neighbors that this is what happens to you. So the failure to pay extortion under certain circumstances, I'm arguing, could constitute civil disobedience.
I see.
And so I think that, you know, the violence is getting so hyper, so horrible that I think we need to look at each case individually. But that has been the posture of the U.S. government, that acts of criminality, extortion, ransom, in and of itself, is not political persecution, but under certain circumstances, I'm arguing it could be. But in this particular case, Jonathan, it's clearly political opinion. I mean, they've got banners, they've got marches, they've denounced it, they've met with politicians, they've got the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very political group that has no other alternative but to denounce their countries and their continent with their feet.
So real quickly, we're almost out of time here. What does this fight, what does this battle for asylum look like for the 61 refugees in the coming weeks and months?
Yes. The battle for these the Hondurans and the few Guatemaltecos and Salvadoreños that came on the caravan looks very favorable. You know, our first task is to get them out from incarceration, join them with their friends and loved ones, and then to pursue their credible fear claims and interviews and then asylum. I've been doing this for over 30 years and one amongst the earliest Mexican asylum cases in the early 90s, and I haven't seen cases this strong coming out of Central America or Mexico ever, because it is a collective political demand of a movement. So there's no way the U.S. government can argue that this does not constitute political opinion. You know, when you have 1,000 people marching, demanding that descending countries desist from being corrupt and violent and abusive, that's classic political opinion, and it's well documented in newspapers throughout Central America and Mexico. It's been news throughout the continent, this flow of people in the form of a movement from one country to another. We're not on the verge of a humanitarian crisis. This is the crisis. When 1,000 people are forced to leave their country and march north, they just ain't fiddling Dixie.
Well, Mr. Spector, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, and again, I salute the Texas Observer. God bless.
Thank you. We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.